For well over 4,000 years in Ireland, the blacksmith has been using the heat of the fire in his forge to bend metal to the desired shape. It used to be that every town and village had, at the very least, one forge and a blacksmith. Often there were many operating in a local area, and none more so than in Skehanna, a small rural community in northeast Galway. In a bid to find out more about the history of one of the well-known blacksmiths who operated in the Skehanna area, I sat down with TJ Scanlon, who lives in the townland of Balla near Menla, and has a very interesting story to tell.
And I suppose my family history was brought home very clearly to me about 3 years ago, when a cousin of ours in Adelaide, Australia, contacted us by internet, or whatever you want to call this thing. And she told me that she was related to us, that her grandmother was MacDonagh. The great-great-grandparents, or whatever you want to call them, were in Killescobe in 1800. And their children immigrated to Huddersfield in England. And if I'm not greatly mistaken, there was a cousin of theirs, a blacksmith in Huddersfield at the time. And three ladies went over to Huddersfield, and one of them married a Barrett man from Mayo, and the two of them immigrated to Australia, to Adelaide. And there was no connection between the Barrett woman and the MacDonaghs until 3 years ago, when she contacted us through internet, or whatever you call this thing, that people can dig it all up. And she told me that the parents of the woman that immigrated were married in about 1820, I suppose, or 1810. And the MacDonagh married a woman from next door. She was Mannion from next door. And that house now is Usher's. My great-grandfather then, Patrick MacDonagh, he was buried up in Menla in 1904. So he'd have been a blacksmith, and there was one before that. They were born in 1800, and the father of the people that immigrated to where we were talking about there. My grandfather's brother William, immigrated to England, presumably Huddersfield, and he worked there for a few years, and he sent home the money to build the forge that's over there on top of the hill. Now, before that, the house, the old house, was down the hollow beside Byron's, and the forge was there too. But they built a new forge up on top of the hill, as we call it, and the landlord gave them the site to build it. That would be Brown down there in Carnacraig. And added to that, he sent my grandfather to Dublin for something like 6 weeks, or I don't know, some short period enough, to practice and learn as much as he could in some smithing business in Dublin. And he came back home, and he was a good smith, from what you'd hear. I never knew the man because he died before I was born. But William immigrated to Boston shortly after, well, he came back from England, he immigrated over to Boston. And my grandfather's, that was one brother, and my grandfather's other brother was Johnny, and he immigrated to Boston as well. Both of them worked there, and William had a forge in Boston. And both of them worked. Now, whether they were effectively working for somebody else, smithies, they were showing the horses for the, I think it's the postal service or whatever, it was all horses at that time that was pulling the loads anyway. And they'd be quitted in the evening and coming home. And William, and on occasion, would take off a little bit ahead of Johnny, and he'd knock at somebody that would be very easily annoyed if they didn't like the individual, or if you were inclined to walk ahead. And he'd win, he'd knock at the door of somebody, and he'd have it timed in such a way the door would be just open when Johnny was passing. And did you knock at the door, you know, the usual, that sort of thing. That type of character, now, he was funny. But Johnny came back to Ireland sometime after in the middle of the war, around that period of time. And the forge at that stage was idle, so he took over the running of the forge and he ran it until, I'd say, the 60s anyway.
What kind of work were they doing within the forge for people around the place?
Oh, well, they'd be shoeing horses, naturally enough, making the shoes and fitting them and all of that type of thing. They would be also making socks for the ploughs. You'd have to do that, so they were able to turn those out. And there were another item they were making would be grubbers, as they call them, for tilling in along the drills of potatoes. This was a machine, if we want to call it that, with one, two, three little scoops of things that went down into the earth, and there was a frame holding them together, and you had two handles at the back of it, and the horse was out in front pulling it, and there was a little wheel on the very front that floated along over the soil, so it didn't actually go down into the very bottom of the earth, if you like. That kept it at a level, you know, that you could work on. You could raise the handles and balance it with the wheel, and you'd let it down a bit more if you thought you wanted to dig a bit more, or pull it up if you thought it was going too far. So that was the grubber, as they called it. And they made them. There's some bits and pieces of those to be seen round the place all the time. Now, I don't know if my grandfather did a lot of that. Some people did a lot of that type of thing. I'm not sure if he did, and I cannot say that he didn't either. He purchased a very large, at the time, a very large drilling machine, hand operated, that stood, when it was in open place, something like 6 foot high, and it had a very large wheel up at the top to give it a bit of impetus in twisting it. Once you got the wheel turning, the thing would go through, naturally enough, without putting a lot of pressure on you. That was the idea of the large wheel. Once you got it spinning, dude, and it had a feeding mechanism that induced the bits to go through the steel or iron, whatever you want to call it, and board. So he bought one of those, and that was unique for the period we're talking about, because there certainly wouldn't be anything of the nature in the country. And I don't think he did an awful lot with it. I thought that now, but maybe I'm wrong. But he did have that, and he obviously saw something like that when he spent his 6 weeks in Dublin or whatever. So he was up to date with that end of the business. How much work there would be for that in the community or the area, I don't know.
But he would have done a lot of work for the local landlord who had sent him off in this original course.
Oh, yes. See, Brown obviously came up and gave him all his work, whatever it was. And I remember coming up to the 20s, I suppose. I remember hearing this. I don't remember. But the cattle driving experience, you know what I'm talking about, and that, where people were trying to get rid of the landlords and they were pulling their cattle out on the road and all the rest of it. And even though Brown had provided him with the site for the forge, he gave some cutting equipment to remove the locks off the landlord's gate. Now, you wouldn't have too far to go if you were examining the thing to understand that what cut the lock must have been from a specialist place, and the blacksmith would come into question on that end of it. But I remember the hearing that the landlord got a bit annoyed with Pat McDonough at some stage or other, and he wasn't altogether responding as he should, it seemed, to whatever he was doing. And he actually hit him with his, I don't know, the whip or whatever he had. And that was unusual. But maybe it was after that that he supplied the machinery to cut the locks. I don't know. He was also a very tasty little individual. He wasn't very tall. He was smaller than me. Now, my mother told me fairly often he'd be about 5 foot, 7 or 8, or that kind of way, I'd say. But he would walk. There was nothing, no other way of going. He was a great walker. And he could, I remember them telling me that he walked to Athenry. And the people were going into Mass in Skehenna, obviously first Mass. And they were coming out from Mass in Athenry when he arrived. That would be second Mass. So 2 hours, we said, to walk from our place to Athenry was fairly lively. But getting back to it, he was an individual that liked to keep himself neat and tidy, as I said. And on one occasion, the church was very well filled in Mindland. He had to go all the way down to the altar and go over to the side of the church where there was a bit of room where the choir would be singing now today. And coming up the altar, you genuflect, as we do. And he genuflected in a mild kind of fashion. He didn't put the knee down too far. And the priest obviously knew that he was rather careful of his clothes. And he said, "Mr. McDonough," he says, "come back here." He says, "You didn't genuflect there properly. I expect you to touch your knee on the floor. And the floor mightn't be as clean as Pat would have preferred for his suit, so he had to go back and put a bit of dust on the knee." But anyway, that was that story about Pat and getting to Mass. That remains with me. Short of that, the functioning of the forge, it was reasonably well kitted out. As I said, it had the drilling machine, which was large and bigger than you'd expect in a place like that. And it had a little good size on the building itself. And the horses could be handled fairly well inside in it. And I remember seeing Jimmy Lahin, as far as I can remember now, doing a bit of, he spent, I'd say, a short period of time there now, maybe a year. But I saw Jimmy making the shoes and fitting them. And when you'd have the shoe nicely warmed, you wouldn't have it, you know, red hot, but to be fairly hot, you brought the shoe to the horse's hoof and you imprinted the shoe on the hoof to burn it. You'd see the smoke appearing off the hoof of the horse to get to level it. And you had that done, and obviously then when they took away the shoe, if there was a high point, obviously you'd say there was a low part where the shoe hadn't touched burning, you paired the high spot and leveled it out properly. And there was a difference then, something I remember from hearing from Johnny, they'd be shoeing the horses for the, as I said, whatever it was in Boston, they were running fairly lively. And here they'd put it, I forget the word now, they put a turn on the nail, drive the nail in fully, twist the top of the nail and break it off, we said, just outside the hoof. And then they'd put the pincers under the top of the nail and they'd tip down the nail and bend it on the hoof so that it wouldn't come out. But in America, where they were driving horses, and if a horse stood on the edge of the shoe and it didn't give, the horse would fall and cause a bit of angst and consternation and maybe hurt somebody. So they didn't turn the nail in America. The nail was left straight. They just broke and left straight. And if the horse was unlucky enough to have the other horse step in her shoe, she just pulled her foot up and left the shoe after her. So that was something that I hadn't heard of before.
TJ, can you explain to me, in terms of the working of the forge, how they would make the rim for the wheel of the cart?
Well, that was, I suppose, looking at it now, it was simple enough, but it was complicated in its own time. The particular flag on which the wheel would be laid had to have a centerpiece that allowed the hub of the wheel of the cart to go down, because it stuck out outside the spokes. And you let that down in the thing. But anyway, the bowel pass had a steel, what would you call it at all, anvil, if we want to call it, big enough at the full size of a wheel and the centre removed on it. And he bought that up in Dublin and it was sent down to him to be collected up in Woodlawn and brought down by horse and cart to Mindle, and it was set up outside the forge. But getting back to what they did when they had to They got the wheel from the carpenter, and the carpenter would be there also with them. And they lifted down on this particular gauge, if you want to call it that. And they measured round about the wheel. And in measuring the wheel, they didn't have tapes. But they had a piece of, a round piece of like heavy, well, not heavy tin, heavier than tin. And a fork made and a handle on it. And that spun around within in the thing. And they walked round about in holding it on the edge of the wheel and put a mark where they started, and they counted every twist the circle gave until they arrived back to the other part of it, and then was it a half one that went with it or whatever. And the tricky part of this is that you had to know the iron contracts when it cools. So they had to know just how much extra or how much less. They had to know the exact size required to have it contract to make it tight on the wheel. So they measured it out, naturally enough, put their stokes where they were, and then they had to go and weld with the hammer, get the fire going well with the bellows, and redden it up in the inside in the forge, and bring it up in the anvil and hammer it together.
Like, huge skills involved. You're bringing physics into it, you know, in times that you didn't have implements that we would take for granted now.
That's true, yeah. The tyre was hot, heated round about, and they brought the tyre out with two big pincers, and they left it down on top of the timber wheel, and it started to burn slightly. Now, it wouldn't be taking fire per se, but it would burn a bit to make its way. And they drove it down on the wheel with their hammers, and if it was too hot, they'd put a dash of water in it to cool it down and work all the way round about and get it down to where it fitted on the width of the timber, and the iron was the same. And then when it cooled, as I said, it contracted and it stayed on that wheel without anything necessary to hold it. There were no screws or nails required to hold the iron on the wheel, which was magnificent in its time. That was the most complicated thing I'd say they were doing, and looking at them, it seemed to be simple because they knew what they were at and how to do it, and they just got on with the job.
What about the conditions that would have been at play there in the forge? I'd imagine it was smoky, it was hot, it was difficult conditions to be working in.
Not that smoky now, there was a good chimney in it. Having said that, now, the coal dust had blackened the inside of the forge. That looked black, blackish. Now, you'd know that there was the difference between timber and the wall and that, but it had darkened it certainly. And there was a very good glow in the fire, actually enough, when they got it going, and the chimney was right over it, and it had a little bit of a, what would you call it at all, a small make of a chimney, just that went out over the fire, a small bit up, high enough, you wouldn't be able to actually get to touch it with anything you were doing, so it was just high enough up. And I worked the bellows myself. You'd have to catch a hold of the, it's like a shaft of, it'd be about, I'd say, 8 foot long, and a nice little handle feeling on it, and you cut the upper end of it and you worked it up and down like this, and it blew the fire. And if they wanted it coming a bit redder, they told you, and they didn't waste any time in telling you either, because everything had to be done promptly if you were dependent on doing it within the heat span of whatever you were at. So it had to be done fairly lively for them.
It was a central part of the community here, though, the job that your grandfather had, that particular trade, and it was a meeting point as well for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah, it was. There'd be a lot of people that would come there and maybe spend a bit of time there talking, and I don't know if that would go down too well with Pat now, whether they stayed too long around. He'd be entitled to tell them to get out of there. And but they would, yeah, they would. It was a nice sort of a meeting place. And you'd have a chat with the Jimmy Lahine, when I'd be calling to him now, you'd have a chat with him and you'd be delighted to see him. And he'd do the job specifically for your requirements, if you like, whatever you wanted to do, they'd do it in the way you'd say, or they'd advise you that what you were talking about wasn't appropriate. So you had to move then to what they were saying to you. And there was a lovely meeting of people there. Now, what I'm talking about, my experience would be in the later years. So there wasn't as many calling there in my time as there was, obviously, 30, 40, 50 years before that. So that there'd obviously be a lot of people coming and going.
Wasn't there a lot of blacksmiths in a relatively small area, TJ?
There was. There was two here, and one in Killescobe and one in Mindla, Rowan's. And one Rowan man immigrated to the States, came home, and he married and moved to Waterloo. Now, I don't know if he actually buy the place in Waterloo, and I think he may have. And he opened a forge there. So that was three forges in a small area here. And you had two in Skihanna, at least two, that springs to mind at the moment. So that would be five forges in the parish of Mindla, which isn't very big by comparison to other places. And there was a lot, I suppose, there was a lot of horses. And horses had to be shod to keep them right and be able to work and keep the show going. So they were keeping the whole thing in motion by virtue of the fact that they were able to do what they were doing. And as things changed then, that dropped out because the tractor arrived with rubber wheels and all of that type of thing. And there was a bit to be done all right. But as time progressed, people were more inclined to buy new parts to replace whatever was there before that, so they wouldn't be calling to the blacksmith as often as they were to repair the machines they had.
So was it a gradual wind down for your grandfather's forge?
It was. In the 60s, I said Johnny McDonough arrived over from Boston, and he was a bit sophisticated now, I suppose, in my estimation, in his time. And he liked to look the part of an individual that was doing fairly well. And he didn't portray himself as a blacksmith per se. He looked like somebody that was teaching or whatever. And I think that gene might be in the McDonoughs anyway. They tended to look the part. But Johnny was a nice individual, and he kept the forge going. Now he wouldn't be into the machinery end of the business. He'd be more just on the shoeing the horses and that, and maybe a small bit outside of that, but it wouldn't be a lot. No, that was his. And then as the tractors took over, there wasn't that many horses, and he had shoed up into 70 or near enough. And he lived with his niece down in Carnacraig after he closed in the forge, and that's where the thing wound down. And I'd say it was in the mid-60s, I'd say, now that he finished there. And he's buried in Mindla in the McDonough grave, same as where my grandfather is. They're both buried there in the one grave.
Did the conditions that they were working in, you think, have any impact on them health-wise?
Well, as far as Johnny was concerned, certainly not, no. He lived to be 75 or 6, I'd say, anyway. Pat McDonough went a bit early in life, all right. But so did his good wife, and she was dead before him. And she was from Mullaghmore, Carrigs down in Mullaghmore. You know where Eddie Kine lives there, or Kines. That was Carrigs, and that's where she came out of. So you'd be related to half the country, and they'd often say around here you couldn't fire a stone, but you'd hit someone belonging to you.
Now, I believe there's an interesting story to do with three gates that you have here around the house.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that was another part of the equation, if you like. The landlord here was Johnston from Lanesborough. And he suggested or presented the people here, and this is Costello's house for my time. Next door was Kelly's, and the house after that was Mulray's. And it was like as if he wanted the farms to look fairly respectable on this portion of road. There was houses down the other way, and I don't know where they got the gates, but anyway. He told them that he'd obviously have a blacksmith working for himself now down in Lanesborough, that a big farm, big house, and the usual landlord type. And I remember a few years ago, breaking off a small bit from that now, calling into Johnston's garage outside Longford. And he told me they were the same Johnstons. And he said, if you want to, he says, you can go to Lanesborough. That's how they're still there, he says, and you can have a word with them. And they might have some of the collections of the money, the records of what they collected around Bala to be had, but I didn't get back there after that. Anyway, the landlord, he must have an interest in seeing that the place looked right along the road where people would be passing through. And he suggested that he had, or he'd provide them with a new gate. And they were specifically made, a lovely type of old gate, with a circular piece of iron, tipping the top of the middle of the gate and going down to the bottom on either of the uprights. And the crossbars then would be closer in the bottom than they would up near the top. So they were very well done. And to say that they were very well done, I have to say that they're still in existence. And that must be very well, over 100 years ago, anyway. And our neighbour here, Edward Kelly, or his father, possibly his father, I remember Edward, might have been Edward too, no, he died in the 50s, I'd say, must have been Edward. He drove his horse and cart from Bala, right here, down to Lanesborough, and he collected the three gates and brought them up here and left one to Costello, one to himself and one to Mulray's. And then they put up what we describe as large pillars. They'd be 2 foot square at least, if not more. I said more. They'd be made with stone anyway, and plastered and hung the gate on them, and they looked beautiful. Our particular gate out there is distorted in as much as that a cow, on one particular occasion, and not too terrible long ago, second one, jumped over it, or partially jumped over it, and landed bang in the middle of it and bent it. So that was a pity. So there we are. That's how it happened.
As you reflect on it now, and with all the knowledge that you hold yourself from your family connection, what do you think are your lasting thoughts on the contribution that your grandfather made to the history of this community?
I didn't look at it that way, but they did an awful lot of work, and it mightn't always be paid per se, but if they weren't paid by cash, the individual would come and give them a hand making the hay or the turf or whatever. So there was lots of ways of contributing to the men's funds without actually parting with cash. I'm not saying that he worked for everyone for nothing, or that couldn't happen, but it was part of what they did at the time. And that was understood in the way things worked. But it was a way of keeping society moving, if you like, keep it functional. And you had something there that shod the horses and kept them going, and they wouldn't be looking for twice their wages, if you want to look at it that way. I'd say there was a limited amount they could get for what they were doing, and they certainly weren't adding on any more than was necessary. So I think they contributed in a great way.